I'm Barney Twiss in the religion department here at FSU. Welcome to this lecture, which in part is celebrating our 50th anniversary of the Department of Religion at FSU. There will be other events after this one in the spring semester, and I encourage you to visit the department website to find out about those events, their dates, times, and topics. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today, Ron Green, professor of religion and the Eunice and Julian Cohen Professor for the Study of Ethics and Human Values at Dartmouth College. He is now Professor Emeritus, I believe, but he's also continues as member of the Department of Religion and the Department of Community and Family Medicine at Dartmouth's School of Medicine. He served for about 10 years as director of Dartmouth's Institute for the Study of Applied and Professional Ethics. He holds a degree from Brown University, where I was on the faculty for a number of years. And he received his doctorate in religious ethics from Harvard University in 1973. He was, or is, or was, the founding director of the Office of Genome Ethics at NIH, and his research interests range broadly across genetic ethics, biomedical ethics, ethics in organizations, professional ethics, comparative religious ethics, and so on. He is the author of 9 books and author of more than 170 articles in theoretical and applied ethics. His 3 most recent books are Babies by Design, The Ethics of Genetic Choice, Kant and Kierkegaard on Time and Eternity, and Suffering and Bioethics, most recently. He's also the author of Religious Reason and Religion and Moral Reason. Lecture, I believe, is revisiting those earlier works that he wrote in the area of comparative ethics. In 1998-99, he was president of the Society of Christian Ethics, the first of Jewish background, which speaks well, I think, for the scholarly wing of the Society of Christian Ethics. He currently chairs the Ethics Advisory Board of Advanced Cell Technology, a company engaged in stem cell research. He's received a Distinguished Teaching Award from Dartmouth, and in 2005, he was a fellow of the Guggenheim Memorial Foundation. We've been long acquainted since, I think, the Harvard-Berkeley program in comparative values or something like that it was called, back in, the 1970s, I think. In 1981, maybe. Please join me in welcoming Ron for his lecture, the title of which is now hidden, Decoding Religion, Can We Theorize Human Religiousness? Ron.
Thank you so much, Barney. I'll turn off this silliness here and get to here. I'm really honored to be here today and for this lecture on the 50th anniversary of the department. It's a great honor. And also to be among people that I've known for years who are very actively involved in the work of comparative religious ethics. Florida State, with its faculty, has some of the leading individuals in this field. And of course, the Journal of Religious Ethics, which is now situated here, was the place that some of the first and still most enduring work in comparative religious ethics has been done. The journal was founded partly to foster such research. So in one respect, though this is my first visit, it is a homecoming to these basic issues and concerns. Now, I have to stay close to my computer to push the button on that PowerPoint, so I'm a bit over here, but I'm going to read this lecture. Hopefully we'll have time at the end for some questions and answers. Hence the title, Decoding Religion, Can We Theorize Human Religiousness? Anthropologists report that religion is a cultural universal. Every known society possesses some form of religion. And there is no traditional human culture lacking a religious component. How can we understand this? What is the source of this universal human phenomenon? But while religions everywhere contain views of the world as inhabited by gods or supernatural beings, and that's one of the common features, there are also remarkable differences from culture to culture in the myths, rituals, and moral prescriptions of religious communities. Thus, our question is, how can we understand the commonness and diversity of religious beliefs, practices, and moral norms? How can we understand this complex phenomenon? In the past few hundred years, anthropologists, philosophers, and theologians have all attempted to answer these questions. Theories of religion abound. My aim today is not to present or evaluate these many theories. Instead, I want to begin by returning to a debate that began in the 1970s. Over how we might understand and compare the specific moral teachings of religions. That debate began in the pages of the then newly founded Journal of Religious Ethics, whose editorial offices, as I've mentioned, are now here. It involved ethicists, philosophers, and students of comparative religion. The question before these scholars was, quote, how can we understand the similarities and differences among the ethical teachings of the world's religion, unquote. During that period, in the pages of the journal, I contributed to the debate by offering what has since been described as a grand theory of religion and religious ethics. That theory was based on the work of the 18th century philosopher Immanuel Kant, aided by recent insight drawn from my own graduate school mentor, the Harvard philosopher John Rawls. Like Kant, I sought to use ethical theory to disclose a universal and rational structure of thought underlying all ethical and religious systems, and to use this structure for the purposes of comparing and understanding different religious ethical systems. Hence, my investigative tool was rational moral theory. I later developed this position in two books, Religious Reason, 1979, and Religion and Moral Reason in 1988, both published by Oxford. In a moment, I'll return to this theory, but its immediate relevance here is that it became one position in a heated debate about how to best approach the task of comparative religious ethics. Another position was provided in a landmark 1978 book, Comparative Religious Ethics, A New Method, by two ethicists, David Little and Sumner Barney Twiss, now a distinguished FSU professor. In opposition to any grand theory of religious ethics, Little and Twiss's work sought to offer a classificatory scheme designed to help organize the different ways in which religious traditions reason about moral choices. It distinguished three different levels of authorizing reasons for the performance of an action. These levels of reason were arranged in an appellate fashion. They included situational application of moral norms to specific choices, validation of those norms, and finally vindication, an understanding beyond immediate choice itself of why the basic norms should be accepted. Because the aim of this approach was to provide a framework for comparing traditions it lacked any deeper account of the origins of religious ethical life or theoretic explanations for the diversity found there. In essence, and Barney may not agree with this, Little and Twiss's approach was a thoughtful typology or taxonomy of religious ethical teachings. As the debate continued, however, it soon became clear that neither my grand theoretical approach nor Little and Twiss's careful taxonomy pleased many people working in comparative ethics. Particularly unhappy were the anthropologists and ethnographers whose work focused on discrete religious traditions. With almost one voice, they argued that my grand theory and even the more modest classificatory scheme of Little and Twiss amounted to the imposition of Western rationalist frameworks and distortions of indigenous cultural traditions. In a 1986 article in the JRE, I and another ethicist, Charles Reynolds, defended a shared theoretical approach to comparative ethics by raising questions about an article in the same issue by K.A. Reed entitled "The Fleeting Moment: Cosmogony, Eschatology and Ethics in Aztec Religion and Society." Replying to us two issues later, Professor Reed underlined the problems she saw in such grand theories. "This approach," she said, "is dangerously imbalanced in its emphasis on similarities, ignoring the importance of diversity for interpreting cross-cultural phenomena, and tending to impose a heterogeneous conceptual framework on all religious ethical systems examined. Using the case of the Aztec ethic, the paper argues instead for an approach that studies each particular system in depth in its own context." I think Professor Reed's comment summed up what so many of the ethnographers and anthropologists were saying to us. From this time forward, the debate in comparative religious ethics became somewhat polarized and frozen. This doesn't mean there aren't many very good studies, some by FSU faculty, but the polarization continued. On one side stood scholars drawing on the resources of Western ethical theory and moral philosophy to understand religion and moral reasoning in other traditions. Some were grand theorists like me, while others were classifiers like Little and Twiss. But all of us were described as formalists and were faulted for imposing the concept and categories of Western thought. On the other side stood defenders of thorough ethnographic and textual studies without theoretical presuppositions. This approach was variously described as naturalist, perspectival, or holistic. FSU's own John Kelsey summed up the state of the debate in a 2012 Journal of Religious Ethics article when he said, "A survey of developments over the last 40 years suggests that little progress has been made in the development of comparative religious ethics as a discipline. While authors working in this field have produced a number of interesting works, the field lacks structure, including an agreement on the basic purpose, terms, and approaches by which contributions may be evaluated as better or worse." What is most disturbing about these debates to me is that in the rush to judgment against the employment of theoretical approaches like my own, relatively little attention was given to any close-grained or data-driven analysis of the value of such an approach. Occasionally, comparativists like Reed or Francisca Cho would offer up a provocative example of a feature of an indigenous non-Western tradition that seemed to contradict a conclusion drawn from ethical theory. This, of course, is precisely how the testing of any theory of religious ethics should proceed. But there was relatively little follow-up of such analyses, and even less debate and dialogue about the significance of the problems identified. Instead, such contradictions were taken as proof that the theoretical approach was useless, and that comparative ethics, should confine itself to the rich, holistic development and understanding of the specific resources of religious traditions. Disappointed by this lack of follow-up, and attracted back to some of my earliest work in bioethics, from the 1990s on, I focused on issues of prenatal medicine and genetics, and even served, as Barney has pointed out, a stint as director of the Office of Genome Ethics at the NIH. It was an amazing time to be there, since the NIH was funding the Human Genome Project, whose aim was to identify and decode all the genes that underlie human biology, our famed double helix. As I worked with scientific colleagues, I turned over in my mind the following questions. How do scientific studies proceed? What is the role of data and theory in the study of phenomena, be they biological organisms or complex cultural forms like religious systems? What was happening before my eyes at the NIH was a revolution in biology. It is perhaps a bit extreme, but I think fair to say that up until the modern revolutions in genetics, biology was barely a science. Taxonomy, in the form of the detailed description and classification of organisms, prevailed. It is true that evolutionary theory sought to provide an explanation of how these differences might have arisen through natural selection, but no specific answers were available for such important questions as why organisms have the features they do, and precisely why those features differ from species to species. Molecular biology changed all that. We now understand in precise chemical and physical detail why and how the mosquito acts as a host for the malaria parasite. And we are even making genetically modified mosquitoes that might resist parasitic invasion. In discovery of the FOX2P gene, we are even beginning to understand why it is that humans have the power of speech, while our nearest primate relatives do not. Modern molecular biology, in other words, now offers a deep theory that is able to provide explanations of the underlying causes of organismic features and variations, and is able to offer at least modest predictions of organisms' morphology out of this explanatory base. In this, it has gone far beyond taxonomy. Consider these examples. In this slide, we see two creatures that look remarkably alike. On the basis of many features, they might appear to be closely related. However, the one on the left, the flying squirrel, is a placental mammal that is found throughout North America, while the one on the right, the sugar glider, is a marsupial mammal that inhabits Australia and New Guinea. Genetic analysis reveals that these two creatures are at opposite ends of the mammalian spectrum, and that we human beings are more closely related to the flying squirrel than flying squirrels are to sugar gliders. A separate non-genetic and environmental explanation, known as convergent evolution, explains the similarities between these very different animals. One more example. On the lower right, you see a magnificent whale. On the left, a group of familiar mammals known as even-toed ungulates, or arteriodactyls. Who could imagine that on the basis of appearance or even many taxonomic features, that these two classes of creatures are closely related to one another? Yet that is exactly what recent genetic analyses have confirmed. The point here is that science in any form requires us to understand and explain how the features of a phenomenon or system have come to be and taken the form they have. At least modest prediction of the resulting forms follows as both a confirmation and a test of theory. Description, however rich, is not enough. nor are taxonomy and classification science in the full sense of the word, and they can even be misleading without a deeper explanation of the system's features. So, if we wish to bring religious studies generally and comparative religious ethics in particular into the realm of science, that is, make it a discipline that provides generalizable insight into the meaning, causes, and consequences of religious phenomena, then we must go beyond useful holistic studies and taxonomies and seek deeper theoretical explanations of why religious ethical systems have the features that they do. This returns me to the enterprise I began 40 years ago. In the remaining sections of this lecture, I want to do two things. First, I want briefly to present the outlines of the theory of religion I developed back in the 1970s. I especially want to highlight the value of this approach for the comparative analysis of religious ethical systems. Second, I want to make very clear what this theory is not, what it does not purport to do. Many of the rejections of this approach have described it as the brute imposition of Western concepts in ethics and religion on non-Western or indigenous materials. But I hope to suggest that the underlying concepts of this theory are so basic and so neutral that they can help explain even widely divergent surface phenomena. Nor, I believe, is the task of theorizing well described as an imposition on the data. I will shortly suggest that dialogue with the data is a more accurate description. The deep structure of religious reason has several components, three in particular. At the heart of this theory is the claim that beneath the diversity of all religious thought and action lie three essential conceptual elements that stem from universally present features of human moral life and moral reasoning. The first of these is a method of moral reasoning involving the moral point of view. The second is a set of beliefs affirming the reality of moral retribution. And the third is a series of transmoral beliefs that suspend both judgment and retribution when this is needed to overcome moral paralysis and moral despair in the face of sin or moral transgressions. The first of these elements holds that morality, in all its forms, involves the subordination of each individual's personal desires and interests to those of the common good. Methodologically, this requires each individual to assume the moral point of view, a perspective of impartiality before the choices and issues facing each of us as moral agents and the community of people in which we are involved. It assumes reciprocity in thinking, putting myself in others' shoes, the golden rule in its many forms, and it asks us to reason as though we could be any one of the people affected by our conduct. For this reason, incidentally, I prefer the term omnipartiality to impartiality, since the former term involves not a detached assessment, but active participation in others' concerns and interests. So it is a taking part in the concerns of all the people that we see as affected by our decisions. The prediction drawn here from theory is that religious ethical traditions will, in various ways, encourage this kind of reciprocity and omnipartiality among their adherents. And they will do this through beliefs, rituals, and the many instrumentalities of religion. The second element insists on the reality of moral retribution, on the fact that the world is so structured that morally good people do not the insistence that the world is so structured that morally good people do not ultimately suffer for their adherence to the moral code, that the wicked are punished and the righteous are rewarded. In addition, since people's inner intentions are the most accurate measure of their moral worth, and because people are capable of hypocritically simulating moral regard, religions will predictably understand the retributing agency to be capable of penetrating the inner sanctum of the human heart. Time does not allow me to fully develop here the reasoned reflections that lead to the need for and insistence on the reality of moral retribution. Suffice it to say briefly that in demanding moments of moral choice, human practical reason, the reason involved in choice, is in conflict with itself. On the one hand, morality as impartial reasoning takes the individual out of himself or herself and requires us to assess our conduct from the standpoint of all the others we affect. On the other hand, prudential reason always counsels the pursuit of our own self-interest. Unfortunately, there is no third or higher employment of reason that can fairly settle this conflict, so that in instances of moral choice, reason is unable to guide us. This is an unusual and unique situation where the reason we rely on to choose and act leaves us directionless. However, there is a way that individuals can act in a coherently rational manner. They can choose to act morally and believe that moral and prudential reason ultimately never conflict. Although it may stretch credulity, it is not irrational to believe that there are powerful agencies or causalities beyond our everyday experience that are able to punish selfish choices and reward righteous ones. This is where religious beliefs enter, and where, as I have argued, human reason itself becomes religious. We can think of human religiousness, in other words, as arising from an effort to preserve reasoned conduct in a world where reason is sometimes sharply in conflict with itself. This association of religious belief with human rationality, incidentally, is why religion is a universal human phenomenon, and it is why it is also only a human phenomenon. There are no animal religions that we know of. The third element of the deep structure of religious reason arises from an implication of the second one, the insight that no one is rationally required to be moral. Individuals who choose to act morally do so because they value this component of their reasoning, and because they have voluntarily accepted the beliefs needed to sustain it. But no one must do this. There is no higher commanding function of reason. As a result, in the face of repeated opportunities to defect from moral conduct, most of us will occasionally do so. This is the source of what Kant, in his famed book, Religion Within the Bounds of Mere Reason, called the radical evil of human nature. Although Kant was clearly influenced by his own Christian background, his effort in that book was to develop the kind of ethically based approach to comparative religion that I have sought to refine. All human beings occasionally defect from morality. This raises a question. How can we ever achieve or recover a sense of moral worth and the confidence that we are basically good persons? Without a satisfactory answer to this question in the face of repeated moral failures, belief in the reality of retribution can even lead us to moral paralysis and moral despair. We can give up on our own moral project. To avoid this, religions typically provide an answer. The third element of the deep structure tells us that if we acknowledge our moral imperfection and renew our efforts at moral improvement, we can reasonably hope that our past moral failures will be erased or overlooked, that moral retribution for us will be suspended, and that we can avoid the harsh punishments we otherwise deserve. The larger moral order, in other words, has room for sincere and repentant confessions of wrongdoing. Obviously, this third element of reason's deep structure is in tension with the second one. The suspension of retribution puts the moral order itself in question, just as acts of mercy always threaten strict justice. But given the human condition, speculation on how we can survive in a demanding retributive order without undermining that order is an inescapable question of the moral life, and religions provide many diverse answers to it. Without pursuing this matter further here, I can suggest that the nearly universal religious practice of ritual sacrifice as a means of expiation of sin is closely tied to this problem in moral reason. That, in a nutshell, is the theory I proposed and developed nearly 40 years ago. As we saw, however, this theory received an abrupt and largely unwelcoming response. The principal reason for this, I believe, is that critics took it to be making bold claims that ran counter to their well-founded knowledge of the traditions they studied. But in fact, these claims, on my part, often only existed in the minds of the critics. This theoretical position is far more modest and nuanced than the critics allowed. Having laid out the spare lines of the theory, let me now spell out clearly what this theory is not, what it does not claim to do. First, although this approach is rooted in a commitment to a universal method of moral reasoning and predicts the existence everywhere of common patterns of moral reasoning, it does not claim that all religious traditions teach the same thing or espouse the same moral values and rules. Moral reasoning and the promotion of reciprocity and mutual respect are highly context-dependent and situational. What works in one environment will not work in another, and conditions that foster one response to human respect may even change over time. The highly varying sexual norms of religious traditions illustrate the challenge of ordering human life. While polygamy was a religiously sanctioned response to a deficit of males in early Islam and Mormonism, changing conditions have brought both traditions' teachings under review. It does not follow from this that either tradition is immoral or that it did not try to create a harmonious and flourishing community of mutual respect in its time and place. This theory does also not claim that all communities act morally or foster regard for all other persons. In fact, few human communities ever reach the stance of universal respect for others that the Kantian ethic underlying this theory advocates. This is because impartiality and reciprocity of reasoning, though usually intensely insisted upon within communities, rarely reach beyond the group's boundaries. We are a highly tribal species. So, predictably, while localized religious communities will deploy many instrumentalities, both in terms of beliefs and practices, to foster reciprocity and mutual respect among the group's members, they will often turn those same religious concepts against others and use them to brand outsiders as dangerous foes or subhumans. Nothing in this theory claims that religions make people better or that religious belief systems are associated with enhanced moral conduct. Classical Aztec religion, in which strict rules of moral conduct existed within the group, alongside of the cruelest mistreatment and religiously mandated sacrifice of war captives, is fully comprehensible within this theoretical framework. Second, this theoretical approach is not the insistence that all religions point to a Western conception of God and the afterlife. When Immanuel Kant offered the initial outlines of his theoretical approach, he stated that religious belief in moral retribution must involve belief in an all-powerful, omnipotent, and omniscient creator God, who can apportion just rewards and punishments. Kant also argued that religious beliefs must include an afterlife, where rewards and punishments could be dispensed to those who had died unrewarded or unpunished. But Kant was deeply rooted in Christian piety and knew very little about world religions. When we look more widely, however, we can see that the religious demand for ultimate retribution can be met in many diverse ways. It has been noted, for example, that in Africa, the high god, even where the high god exists, is often morally indifferent or odious. A hymn among the Dinka people of the Upper Nile region says, "Spring rain in a dry spell strikes the ants on the head with a club. And the ants say, 'My father has seen.' And they do not know whether he helps people, and they do not know whether he injures people." Morally distant god. But despite the absence of a morally supportive high god, the Dinka, no less than almost all African tribal groups, believe in a multiplicity of retributing moral agents. Among these are the ancestors. These are idealized former members of the group who at death assume the role of overseers and upholders of familial and tribal moral values. Because the ancestors are believed to communicate with one another and able to see into the hearts and minds of their living descendants, nothing escapes their attention. It is noteworthy here that in indigenous religions throughout Africa, the afterlife, the realm of the ancestors, is not viewed as a place of reward or punishment. This usually occurs in this life, with the ancestors primarily acting as retributing agents. Side by side with the ancestors, many African traditional societies uphold belief in human retributing agents in the form of sorcerers and witches. The former, often male, can be called upon for supernatural assistance in warding off evil, but the latter, witches, are agents of pure malice. Selfish, covetous, often gratuitously harmful, they serve a morally pedagogic purpose as the very anti-type of proper behavior. And children are warned, if you continue acting like that, you'll become a witch. But they also punish wrongdoing. A householder who turns away a beggar at his door must be careful. The beggar may be a witch. And the householder's inhospitable behavior could soon earn its just reward. A husband who unfairly favors one of his co-wives must also beware. A slighted wife might be a witch whose punishments can extend to the death of other wives' children. Adherence to indigenous African religion, therefore, live in a morally saturated universe. Despite the distance of the high god, numerous agencies surround them to morally reward and punish people's conduct and character. If the requirement of retribution does not require a belief in a high creator god, neither does it require a belief in God at all. Although the great traditions that originated in India, Hinduism in its many forms, Buddhism and Jainism, are all populated with gods and goddesses, the principal retributive agency there is not personal. Instead, it is the reality of karma, which operates impersonally, almost like the force of gravity, to bestow reward and punishment in direct proportion to both the deeds and inner intentions of moral actors. Karma is inescapable. Quote, "You cannot hide beneath a mountain to escape it," says one text. Karma can act immediately, as in the punishment experienced by a miscreant who is caught in the act and punished. Or it can take many future reincarnations for its fruits to ripen. In a famous narrative, one of the Buddha's two chief disciples, the sage Moggallana, is murdered by highwaymen. When asked to explain why a saintly member of the community had to suffer such a fate, the Buddha, who possessed the ability to see everyone's previous lives, states that many eons ago, Moggallana, unwilling to support his aged, feeble parents, had disguised himself as a highwayman and killed them in the forest. He's gotten his comeuppance. This illustrates that in concrete religious traditions, retribution can take many varied and unexpected forms. What theory requires and predicts is that a religious tradition will offer beliefs, usually involving supernatural agencies, that uphold a confidence in moral retribution. It does not require or predict that those beliefs take any of the forms familiar in the West. The same is true with regard to religious responses to the third requirement of the deep structure. We're all familiar with Western and biblically derived responses, usually involving conceptions of divine forgiveness for the earnest and repentant confession of sin. In Judaism, the challenge of forgiveness is illustrated by the claim that God has two arms, a right one of mercy and a left one of justice. Why is the right arm the arm of mercy? Because it must be strong enough to put down the arm of justice. Most of us are right-handed. Jewish Christian speculation about the problem of sin probably reaches a crescendo in the writings of St. Paul, who introduced the idea that salvation is not accomplished by any moral performance, what Paul calls obedience to the law, but only by faith in God's grace. In this teaching, Paul recognized that human sinfulness is not only omnipresent, but can even take sophisticated forms, including the pridefulness of law abiders, who think themselves good people, but who use their virtue as an instrument of self-assertion and aggression. Paul's solution to this problem was to cut the retributive link entirely. No amount of moral performance can guarantee one's salvation. All are sinful. Only God, in his graciousness, determines who merits divine favor. But if God acts on the basis of grace, not human merit, how does God decide? And if we have been freed from moral evaluations, why should we even care about morality at all? Why not freely sin? These questions all immediately cropped up in Paul's analysis. In response to the first question, how does God bestow grace? Paul halts the inquiry abruptly. In Romans 9:20, he asks rhetorically, "Does the clay question the potter? How dare you ask?" To the second question, he says, "What shall we say then?" Rhetorically asks, "What shall we say then? Are we to continue in sin that grace may abound?" And to this Paul responds vehemently, "By no means." God's grace does not nullify morality, just the opposite. How can we who died to sin still live in it? Christians who are separated from moral concerns, therefore, and do not worry any longer about their retributive fate, thanks to the receipt of God's grace, according to Paul, experience a new freedom to act selflessly and compassionately. Here we see a detailed playing out of reason's tripartite program. Morality is richly described and required. Love. God's ultimate justice is affirmed. Consciences are sensitized to the subtle forms that sin can take. And human beings are given a freedom from concerns about reward and punishment that ease a paralyzing sense of sin and that returns them newly energized to selfless commitment to others. The whole program is there. The correspondences between Christian thinking and the deep theory at this point may seem to reinforce the suggestion that this theory is little more than a disguised version of Western religious or even Christian theology. Disputing this conclusion would require a global investigation of how other very different traditions respond to all three requirements of the deep structure. I have already suggested that the nearly universal presence of expiatory sacrificial beliefs and rituals fits here. Interestingly, it may be that Christian notions of Christ's expiatory sacrifice are themselves late derived and a special case of what is a more basic and prevalent human religious response to the problem of moral failure. I'm going to read that sentence again. That's a very important sentence. Okay? It may be that Christian notions of Christ's expiatory sacrifice are themselves a late derived and special case of what is a more basic and prevalent human religious response to the problem of moral failure. So this is not Christianity imposed, it's just the opposite. It is universally extended to the Christian case. But we needn't move in that direction. Instead, we can turn again to the world of Indian religion to see a response to reason's third requirement emerging from a very different conceptual matrix. I have already mentioned how these traditions largely replaced the concept of a personal retributing moral agency, God, with an impersonal causation of karma. In many respects, this answered the question of why the righteous suffer or the wicked prosper, the answer being that ultimately they don't, is one of the most brilliant retributive doctrines ever advanced. The great sociologist of religion, Max Weber, said that the karma doctrine, quote, transformed the world into a strictly rational, ethically determined cosmos, unquote. When placed within the framework of moral and religious reasoning, however, karma has its problems. Chief among these is its pitiless operation. In a world governed by karma, there is no room for the suspension of harsh moral judgment. As the story of Moggallana shows us, even saints cannot evade the consequences of their indiscretions. Small wonder, then, as Monier Williams once put it, that karma eventually became the quote-unquote nightmare and daymare of Indian intellectuals. The challenge became to somehow discern a way of escaping the penalties of karma and of obtaining abiding well-being and moral integrity. In Hinduism, this became the quest for moksha or salvation, and in Buddhism, for the extinction of karmic forces known as nirvana. At the level of folk religion, this quest gave rise to the still popular bhakti or devotional cults, where simple devotion to a deity promises release from karmic penalties. Among intellectuals, it stirred a quest for mystical insight into a realm beyond karmic determination. Perhaps the text that best reveals this quest is Hinduism's great classic, the Bhagavad Gita. There we find the warrior Arjuna in the throes of a wrenching moral decision. As a member of the Kshatriya warrior caste and the Pandava clan, he must take up arms against his relatives, the Kauravas, whose wicked behavior has precipitated war. But Arjuna is filled with grief, seeing fathers, grandfathers, uncles, brothers, and sons in the armies before him. He's overcome by revulsion at the impending slaughter. His limbs grow weak, and his body trembles. Casting aside the bow, he slumps down on the seat of his chariot in despair. As one commentator has put it, Arjuna finds himself in a situation where, quote, action for securing order and justice means some sort of involvement in guilt in the absolute sense, unquote. At this moment, Arjuna's charioteer turns and reveals himself as Krishna, an avatar or terrestrial embodiment of the great god Vishnu. In a series of discourses and epiphanies, Krishna conveys to Arjuna a mystically perceived truth. Wise men, he says, do not mourn for the dead or the living, for there has never been a time that any of us ceases to be. As the soul of this body passes through childhood, youth, and old age, so, after departure from the body, it passes on to another body. In its course, the soul remains unaffected by the objects of sense. It is untouched by what happens to it and what it does. It is never really born, and it never really dies, but is eternal and everlasting. And Krishna concludes, he who thinks this soul is a slayer, and he who thinks this soul is slain, both of them are ignorant. He concludes with this advice to Arjuna, therefore fight, O Bharata. Do your duty. Do your Kshatriya duty. Here, in a conceptual context, far different from any Western one, and in a strikingly different form, we see a profound and enduring response to the human rational need for release from the merciless force and penalties of moral self-judgment. God and divine forgiveness here are replaced by the insight that one's essential being is untouched by karmic taint. In both the Eastern and Western cases, we are at the limits of religious and moral reasoning. Paul's implied idea of predestination and the Gita's vision of a morally stainless soul stretch the limits of morality and rational thought. But both do so in order to assuage moral self-judgment. Predictably, in both cases, these efforts lead not to moral indifference or abandonment, but to an impassioned encouragement to resume one's duty. In the face of the temptation to moral defection, Arjuna's "therefore fight, O Bharata," is the Eastern analog of St. Paul's "by no means." In both cases, a state beyond morality is put forth not as a rejection of morality, but as a means to its egoless, purified fulfillment. Returning to what this theory is not, I can say third that the approach I am advocating is not a complete theory of religious belief and behavior. Two specific observations are pertinent here. First, as we can see from many of the examples I have offered, the three basic elements of religious reasoning can underlie radically different religious forms and expressions. Why this is so requires an understanding of many other causal processes, including those related to the specific cultural contexts and historical experiences of the traditions. Thus, once India gave pride of place to the concept of karma, it was probably predictable that the moral role of the high gods would be attenuated. Contrast this with biblical religion, where military threats to tiny Israel's national survival intensified the effort to fathom God's will and led to the appearance of the prophets, with their insistence on an even greater degree of human sinfulness and need for covenant obedience. So these traditions went in very different directions under the duress and stress of historical and social experience. A scientific analogy, once again, may help us understand the theoretical point I'm making here. Although molecular biology has dramatically enhanced our understanding of biological organisms, it is not in itself sufficient to explain the forms those organisms take. We need other theoretical approaches for that. Thus, it takes an understanding of creatures' environments and competitors to understand why such genetically distinct animals as the flying squirrel and sugar glider take the similar forms that they do. It takes the same kind of understanding of history and environments to understand how whales diverge from their land-based kin. Not differently, we can use theory to understand the basic conceptual factors that drive religious belief and practice. But to understand the forms that religions take, we must supplement this with close historical and sociological analysis, perhaps even psychological analysis as well. We must also acknowledge that however important ethical reasoning is, religions are also shaped by other anthropological and sociological forces. For example, several recent theorists like Pascal Boyer and Nicholas Wade have theorized that a genetically determined human impulse to music and dance play a major role in the appearance of religious ritual. This tells us that we must investigate all the factors bearing on religious expression. The claim of the theory I am proposing is that moral reasoning plays one very important but not exclusive part. Fourth and finally, the theoretical approach I offer is not an imposition of theory on data. Francisca Cho, in a critique of the theory, in a comparative study, states that when comparative studies are guided by such theories as my own, their primary purpose is, quote, substantiating what the theorists already know, unquote. But I think this totally mischaracterizes how a theory works in relationship to the data. Such an enterprise involves an active dialogue between theory on the one hand and the data that results from intense ethnographic, historical, and textual studies on the other. In this process, theory can help guide the interrogation of data, but it can also be modified by findings from the data. Coming from a Western theistic idea of moral retribution or forgiveness, for example, who could have imagined that the same underlying rational requirements would lead to an ideal like karma, with its impersonal but still retributive focus? Only careful attention to the study of such diverse responses can yield a comprehensive understanding of human religiousness. Let me conclude by saying that the interest of comparative religious inquiry lies in perceiving what is unique and what is shared. It is important to see the degree of initiative and creativity that religious traditions bring to the working out of a common rational agenda. But this agenda must also be kept in mind. It furnishes the guide that enables us to see the universal in the particular, the common human thread amidst so much bewildering diversity. 10 years ago, FSU's Barney Twiss published an essay in the Journal of Religious Ethics, critical of a purely holistic and descriptive approach to comparative ethics. Twiss then imagined a more ambitious approach. Such an approach, he said, would, quote, engage in comparative ethics with the aim of developing a systematic theory or explanation about why human beings construct moral communities in the way they do. That is, exploiting their similarities to develop a scientific explanation of moral behavior, perhaps informed by the disciplines of biology, sociology, and psychology, or by emergent theories within, adjunctive to, and between these disciplines, for example, sociobiology, evolutionary psychology. I will close my remarks by suggesting that 40 years ago, I proposed the beginnings of such a theory, using not the natural sciences, but philosophical ethical analysis as my key tool of investigation. Since that time, that theory has rarely been tested. I restate it today in the hopes that other scholars, perhaps including graduate students here at FSU, will renew the task of determining the role of moral reasoning in the wide and fascinating realm of ethical and religious life. Thank you. Yes.
So, forgive me, I'm a foreigner. I'm Alda Walford Lewis, and I am a graduate student at another university. I'm honored to get to be here for this event. I'm wondering what the payoff is of a universal theory of religious reason for you. Mm-hmm. A lot of what you said suggested to me that it has something to do with making the study of comparative religious ethics more of a discipline, which you take to mean making it more scientifically explanatory in some sense. Mm-hmm. So my question is, why take modern science as a model for contemporary humanistic inquiry? Because it seems to me that one of the great benefits of the study of religion is that it can teach us about diverse ways of knowing that humans use and have used to make sense of their lives, and that modern science is one of these, a very important one, mm-hmm. one that we have mm-hmm. deep respect for, mm-hmm. but that it needn't be the model for all ways of knowing.
I think I would wonder about what I'm not doing once again. I'm certainly not making the claim that this is the only way of knowing. Careful textual, ethnographic, anthropological, historical studies will tell us that there are many other ways that human beings have understood their place in the world and oriented themselves to it. The mystical alone is one such approach that defies, is completely contrary to our own scientific approach. I am suggesting that it is, to the extent that religious, comparative religion and religious studies seeks to understand, it must also engage in a measure of explanation of why it is particular forms emerge, evolve, undergo change. And it also, to some extent, is predictive, even if that prediction is sometimes conceptual or historical. It would argue that certain kinds of responses lead predictably to consequences that can be examined and studied and better understood. So I think that the scientific enterprise with religion is only one such approach, one, but certainly a valid approach in its own right to the extent that one is studying human phenomena. And it will enrich the study of religion generally to develop more rigorous scientific tools for the understanding of religion. These include others as well, such as social psychology, molecular biology. People are invoking molecular biology today to understand features of religious belief and religious belief. All of those are welcome as approaches, but it certainly does not exclude the tool of moral theory, in my case, as one of the explanatory modalities that one might want to employ. Go ahead.
I'm just wondering why moral theory should be scientific.
That may seem peculiar to you. It's peculiar for me even to state it. Science does not always rely upon experimental data and evidence. It involves, above all, the application of rigorous logic to the data under study, and a disciplined method of reaching conclusions with regard to that. Moral theory is predictive in this sense. It is making the claim that this is how human beings reason about moral choices. Practical reason has a structure to it. And that practical reason as a theoretical approach applies not simply comparatively. For example, when a person makes a judgment that a particular form of behavior, violence, is unacceptable, morally unacceptable, the moral theorist is trying to understand the underlying logic of the practical reasoning in that instance. So in that sense, it's an investigative tool. There's a famous joke in the literature here. Immanuel Kant, in the second critique, has a long footnote about five pages in which he takes into account a critic who had said, Kant has provided us no new principles for moral theory, no new principles for moral theory. And Kant in the footnote says, of course not. How could I possibly apply a new, as though human beings had not been moral from the beginning of time and did not exercise moral reflection and moral. My effort is to better understand how and why they do that. And that's the critique of practical reason. Right? So similarly, taking that tool of rigorous logical analysis, I regard that as a scientific enterprise, no less than the use of laboratory experimental techniques to do that. And that is the distinctive feature of my approach. Yes?
Yeah, I would have to disagree with Kant and him saying that people were never moral at one point. But my question is that, do you feel that all of these enterprises to figure out morality is like a conditional statement? Like if you're training the body, that's what we call a condition. So when you have a conditional statement, it's if you do this, then you will have these results. And so my question to you is, do you feel like trying to figure out a correct moral enterprise is just trying to figure out the ultimate conditional statement?
I'd have to raise so many different questions in so many different ways. I think, let me try this. I think the enterprise I sketch for you today is the search, logically and rationally, for conditions. And certainly, yes, the ultimate condition. I think in acting, one is seeking reasons and what underlies those reasons. And as I suggested, those reasons come to a certain kind of an impasse at a certain point. They offer contradictory counsel. So the search is finally for an ultimate condition on which the whole enterprise can rest. in some way. And in that sense, I think it is a search for conditions of what it means to be a. And I would go so far as to say that religion itself is a form of reason. It's a search beyond the world of evidence for reasons and the conditions that underlie our nature as human beings, which includes our moral nature. I think I may not have answered every feature of that question. Yes?
I think I understand most of what you're saying, but I wonder if you might have a thought about the way in which the recognition by the subject of the possibility or not possibility of retribution is really a key part of this. Now, I say that because I work on emotion, and I'm particularly interested in the overlap in theorizing about emotion and in reason. And I ask sometimes when I study American religious history, how people know that they're saved, or how they know they're going to hell, or how they know they're going to heaven. And they oftentimes say, well, I feel like I'm going to heaven, right? Mm-hmm. Or when I was a sinner, I felt like I was going to hell. Mm-hmm. And although I think within the parameters of your theory, there's enough wiggle room there to say that that feeling is a kind of ratiocination, or there's a kind of rational process embedded in that. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering what you would say. I mean, is there a need here to qualify the, in this particular case, the subject's recognition of retribution itself as something which is extra rational? Meaning it could be just something that's represented linguistically or performatively as emotion. And who knows, might be grounded in genomics or might be grounded in endocrinology.
I come back to what I tried to convey today. This is by no means a complete theory of human religiousness, by no means. I feel that emotion plays a key role in religiousness in many, many forms. Our bonding with other human beings in affection, for example. I think it's not accidental that the supernatural agencies are almost always thought of in personal terms, for example, karma being an exception, because we relate better to persons on an emotional level, especially when you can connect that up with the emotions of childhood. So I don't think Freud was completely mistaken to see religion as a childlike response to paternal authority. In some way, he was identifying an emotional stream that religions had picked up and utilized in their self-development and so on. So I think that emotion enters at all different levels of the religious life. The claim I would want to hold to is that religion, what religions try to do, is exploit those emotions. I don't mean to put that pejorative, but to utilize and to turn those emotional features to the moral agenda in some fashion. So the personal is utilized for that purpose. Apprehension and fear of punishment is utilized in that form. The person you're mentioning who experiences that sense of I'm doomed probably comes from a Christian religious environment where since childhood they've heard about sin and hell and punishment, and their own sense of malaise is now being wedded to a religious doctrine that they've heard about. So I think there's a constant interchange and cooperation between the psychological phenomena and the human reasoning enterprise that religions engage in. And by the way, one other point here, they often misuse it. Right? So it's very easy to say that all those infidels are going to hell anyway. Why don't you just expedite them? I'm not by any means saying that religions are ethical, but they exploit everything for their purposes and their misguided purposes.
Okay, I understand that. I'll just follow very quickly, sure. Though, one footnote to that. I don't want to distract you in your discussion of emotion, but, you know, my sense in the areas that I work in, which include lately, you know, economic theory, international relations, some sociology of religion, all have led me to notice a trend away from anything that used to be called rational choice toward something else.
Right.
And that something else is to a large part constructed out of much more fluid personal and cultural materials than people commonly have invoked when they make an argument that is based upon something called reason. Mm-hmm. So I guess the bottom of my question is really, what's to compel us to go what seems to me the opposite way in thinking about religion and re-recover an emphasis upon reason when so much of the rest of what I consider cognate theory is going the other way?
Well, let me say it's exactly what I'm trying to do, is push things a bit the other way. There are influential theories in the study of religion which are highly oriented toward emotion. From Rudolf Otto, the experience of the noumenal, William James, and others, who have rooted religion, understandably, in the emotional life, which, by the way, has defensive value for religion, because then it's in something that can't easily be altered in any way. It also invites the criticism, yes, religion is irrational, and it's emotional, and so on. But whatever the case, this has been highly prevalent. I'm trying to say something very different. I'm trying to say that religion has a major impetus. I'm not saying the sole impetus. A major impetus in the human exercise of practical reason, which is, by the way, not simply the individual who is doing that. It's not as though individuals sit there and work through the whole program of religious. No. Religions face moral challenges, moral demands, moral problems. They exist within a culture. The culture elaborates complex responses, which over time take the form of rational responses because they're critiqued, they're evaluated, they're promulgated. So an individual saying, you know, why should I not cheat tomorrow? Why should I not cheat? Finds in the cultural assembly, the bricolage of the culture, oh, God is looking. God will punish me. Right? And fix that rational belief up, even though he or she has never developed or elaborated that belief themselves. So I'm talking about human culture as a rational enterprise, and it's distinctly different from one that relies on emotional life. Yes?
I have a question that relates to the first question about modes of reason. One reason some people think that particular religious traditions are incommensurable or irreducible in particular is that the explanation they give of their own tradition is different. They differ from each other. And in fact, the self-understanding of different religious traditions differs pretty significantly from what you've identified as a universal thread that's common to them. I'm wondering if it's a problem for your theory, which it might not be, but I'm wondering whether it's a problem if it's the case that particular religious traditions fail to recognize themselves in the universal theory that you presented.
Well, thank you. That's a wonderful question. In Religion and Moral Reason, I have a whole couple of chapters devoted to divine command ethics in the Western religious traditions. Put very simply, these traditions, Islam, Judaism certainly, less so Christianity, would categorically reject the claim that their ethical teachings derive from human reason at all. It is from God, the supreme authority, that we know the difference between right and wrong. So there you have a very clear case of rejection of reason and self-understanding within a tradition. One of the things I argue in those two chapters, and you have to follow the rather convoluted argument, is this is predictable and expected. One, the requirement of reason is to ground moral reason. Reason comes to us, moral requirements come to us ineluctably, inescapably, authoritatively. It's wrong to do what I just did. It's violative of something. They come to us as commands. In the Kantian framework, it's our own commands being issued to us. But they come in the form of command and authority. The problem, of course, is that any self-initiated command and authority is questionable. If this is just me, why should I care about it? So religions will predictably
locate the source of moral authority in an unimpeachable, authoritative, powerful agency beyond human control. Hence, divine command. All the traditions resort to this. Now, the interesting thing is that having done that, they then work their way backward, usually, to rendering those commands pretty reasonable. Command, they're not arbitrary. God is rarely configured as a brute tyrant who just does what God wants to do and so on, but rather is seen in various respects as the father of all, the omnipartial being who cares for all. So they bring that back into reason. And you get major debates in all three of those traditions about divine authority versus reason and so on, which again are predictable within those traditions. So I'm not astonished that traditions find different grounds for what they're doing. The virtue traditions, the Hellenistic traditions, the Chinese traditions, seek to ground it in an anthropology principle, which they put forth, not even divine commands, but in an authoritative anthropology. Fine, do what you want. I mean, my personal response is, do whatever works within your cultural tradition to ground the moral commandment, and expect that. The interest of comparative studies is to look at the different ways that people come up with that.
So the concern is that it sounds like the scientific mode of reasoning or the level of explanation has priority over the mode of reasoning that's native to each particular tradition. Am I hearing you right?
I think that's a false way of putting it. For those within the tradition, their way of reasoning is the most authoritative. For the scientific investigator looking at the tradition, trying to understand why it's making the moves it's making, that is the... One doesn't go and say, well, because Yahweh said this and that. One goes in using a theory of the sort that I propose. There's no reason to challenge or qualify that indigenous tradition-based series of responses. There are two different modes of apprehension. And interestingly, I presume a person can have both. A person can be a student of comparative religion, a devout Jew, fulfill his or her mitzvot because God gave them to me, and at the same time look and say, and understand why they have those mitzvot in a comparative, rational, ethical fashion. I don't think those are even antithetical within the individual. Yes.
Just have to say, I do share the suspicion of science as a model for thinking about these things, but I also can understand why you take the approach. Particularly, I have that suspicion because of sociobiology. I believe it's been thoroughly discredited as unscientific. Mm-hmm. And there are critics among them, and anthropologists who, to my mind, have demolished evolutionary psychology as a credible scientific endeavor as well. But at the same time, and also I think there's this maybe a suspicion from, say, an ethnographic or anthropological point of view of any claim of a universal sort of ethical stance. But at the same time, I hear you and I'm on board with you, because we've heard these sorts of discourses before with the white man's burden, the civilizing mission. Even human rights discourses can be rather imperialistic, and when they've got the power of certain nation states behind them. But That's those are things that are up for debate. What I really appreciate about your approach is that when most folks think about indigenous religions, what people call indigenous religions in Africa, Amazonia, Papua New Guinea, they're characterized as irrational, as undeveloped, as lacking moral insight. Evans Pritchard himself, in writing about Zande divination, said that the Zande used divination as a logical process, but it was irrational. And Peter Winch came along in an essay subsequent to that and said, no, it's rational, it's a rational endeavor, but the rationality isn't grounded in naturalistic logic, it's grounded in a social logic. Mm-hmm. And so I guess I'm wondering if there is also, and you say that this is one approach, and I'm thinking of Habermas, his approach to science and humanistic approaches to questions of morality and philosophy as being maybe an overarching middle ground. And the example from, what's the name of this two-volume work? I'm forgetting it right now. But yes, The Theory of Communicative Action, thank you. In the first volume, he takes the position of the sociologist as the position, and I think he means the ethnographer, really. Germans don't really have an anthropological tradition, the French tradition. But when, in order to explain a person's cultural and moral situation, you have to understand it first. In other words, you have to go into the context, and you have to understand the conditions of daily life to explain the process of reasoning. So what Habermas is doing there is, contrary to Diltai, who was saying that there's a particular method for science which goes towards erklären, understanding, a particular method for the humanities, which privileges understanding, verstehen, the two are involved in a hermeneutical circle, to go back to Schleiermacher. You can't have explanation without understanding. In other words, you can't have the deep structure without an understanding of the ethnographic and historical conditions. And because the explanation depends upon a reference to those particular conditions.
Right.
And so it seems to me that your position, your scientific position, is compatible with some sort of more humanistic or non-scientific position, that there's no reason to see them is opposed.
Many questions there. Let me suggest this. I think the relationship between the kind of theoretical scientific investigation I'm proposing and the detailed comprehension, the Verstehen, if you want, of traditions and cultures, these mutually interpenetrate. They're not separate, they interpenetrate in two ways. First, to some extent, the theory guides the other investigations. It poses questions. It poses questions as to, is it the case that we find a theory of retribution in this cultural tradition? Is our question about righteousness and its reward addressed? So it's posing questions with it. And then, a full and rich understanding of the tradition in its internal complexity and logic and meaning has to be undertaken. And that can come back and it can confirm certain suppositions theoretically, or it can challenge them. It can say the theory has misrepresented what is actually going on. And so the theory, this happens all the time in science. As well, in which the data, we used to live in a Newtonian universe, and now we live in an Einsteinian or a quantum universe, because the data challenged the governing theory at any particular moment, and things were expanded. My disappointment is that we haven't had that conversation with people working within the humanistic studies and ethnographers in social sciences. We haven't had that conversation. We haven't said, let's look at your theory and see whether it guides in any way investigation here, and whether it's challenged by and modified by, or even perhaps falsified by, the data of this tradition. Rather, it's been taken so superficially as one qualifying. I'll give you an illustration of what agitated me. So Kay Reed, who I mentioned, Charlie Reynolds and I made I regard it as a false statement. We said that all cosmologies presume an ethical order and see the decline from ethical order into chaos and sin, and that they approach cosmogony in that fashion, beginning with a perfected ethical order that declines in some fashion. Now, that does apply to a lot of cosmogonies. Kay Reed bodied forth Aztec cosmogony, which never has a notion of a perfected order. The world is constantly degrading in every way. It does not sustain ethical order in any fashion at all. Had this conversation been pursued, and not simply used as saying Green and Reynolds' theory is inadequate, had the conversation proceeded, we would have gone further. We would have said, well, first of all, we take back that statement. Nor is it necessary for the theoretical position that all cosmogonies reflect that. Some do, some don't. So that would have qualified and changed the theoretical approach. The other thing we would have done is pointed out to Kay Reed that there's a strict ethical order within Aztec religious civilization. Despite the fact that the world is going to hell in a basket all the time, the duties of those within the order
to sustain the cosmos before it collapses are rigid and strict to the point of self-flagellation and mutilation, right? So we said, we have to locate the ethical order in a slightly different place within this tradition. And there's a mutual process of conversation going on. It just never happened. A handful of articles came forth that said, this is a grand theory. It's the imposition of Western ethical values on different cultures. It's imperialistic, and so on. And that was the end of the discussion and the debate. There's where it went. Yes.
Thank you very much for your paper. I wanted to, it's interesting following up on Professor Helbig, kind of taking Schleiermacher's hermeneutics, reminding us of Kant's very important point, especially in that long, funny footnote. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to correct something. He said he's not inventing anything because everybody's already moral. Right? There's morality.
They all know what morality is, but he was trying to come up, as he actually said, with a new form.
Yes. But this is interesting because following Professor Helbig, you know, a lot of the turn in comparative religious ethics has been to promote Hegel and his method, and with Brandom and Stout and others like this. But it's precisely a figure like Hegel who would have outed all of Africa as being irrational. And in many other so it turns rationality into this contest, right? One must achieve, and who knows who's the arbiter of the, you know, who gets to judge who becomes rational at some point.
At the end of history.
It turns it into a contest, but with Kant, not so much. And so I found your returning to your earlier project fascinating in a sense, because what you're really saying is just let's test this. Religions, you know, people are rational. People make claims. So let's test where the theory goes and perhaps how much one could explain about religions just looking at their ethical theory. Mm-hmm. Thank you. I thought it was fascinating.
I regard myself as making two really important claims. Let's see if I can, I don't want to be doing oopsie. One is that religion is a rational phenomenon. If you leave this room saying nothing, getting nothing else from what I've said, it is a rational phenomenon.
Yes.
It's derived significantly, not utterly, but significantly from our cognitive, highest cognitive activities. It's not simply emotional, it's not simply functional, it is a cognitive thing. The other element is that we really have to be open to the enormous diversity of solutions that people have come up with to these underlying human problems. And I would never want to argue that these people are not being rational or anything like that. In fact, that's exactly where the dialogue begins to see the many brilliant, clever ways that human beings have tried to address these problems, the moral one. I guess there's a third, and that is religion derives significantly from ethics and morality. I would like to commend that as well. In my, you know, we speak about comparative religious ethics, so I'm actually not that interested in comparative religious ethics. There's good work done in comparative religious ethics. I think we need to look at human rights, as your own faculty here have done, across traditions. We need to find common ground on issues of gender, on human religious freedom, on war. That comparison is very, very important. But I'm more interested in the fundamental role of moral reasoning in the shaping of religious reflection generally, theologically and otherwise. And so my enterprise is actually less comparative than it is theoretical.
With those wise words, we thank you.